Johann Schmiegel, you've got the world's highest IQ.
Yes, 247.
Wow, did you know that thanks to Salesforce with Einstein AI, everyone's smarter? Now everyone's an Einstein, just like you.
But I'm the smartest.
Not anymore. With connected data and trusted AI, everyone can give customers experiences they've only dreamed of. Oh, look, here's a few Einsteins now.
Hey, hi.
Hola, amigo.
Everyone's an Einstein?
It's okay, Johann, let it happen. The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
The case before the Supreme Court is about a challenge to the powers of the SEC to bring legal actions in-house. And it's another example of the conservative justices targeting the administrative state. During the oral arguments, Chief Justice John Roberts expressed concerns over the power of federal regulators.
The extent of the impact of government agencies on daily life today is enormously more significant than it was 50 years ago.
The Jarkissi case could strip the SEC of a key enforcement tool. And conservative justices like Brett Kavanaugh suggested that people accused of fraud by the SEC have a constitutional right to have their cases decided by a jury in federal court instead of by the SEC's in-house administrative law judges.
That seems problematic to say the government can deprive you of your property, your money, substantial sums, in a tribunal that is at least perceived as not being impartial.
A change in the law by the court here could have effects far beyond the SEC, because roughly two dozen agencies, including the EPA, the CFTC, and the Federal Trade Commission, have similar enforcement schemes. As liberal justice Sonia Sotomayor pointed out to Jarkissi's attorney, Michael McCulloch.
All of those agencies will have to go to court, correct?
Well, Your Honor,
all of their proceedings are now nullified under your theory.
And liberal justice Elena Kagan pointed to a 1977 Supreme Court ruling, Atlas Roofing, telling McCulloch it settled the issue and there was no right to a jury trial here.
In a case where Congress has given an agency the power to enforce something and the agency is bringing the charge, if you will, that's settled.
Well, it's settled only to the extent no one's brought it up and forced this issue since Atlas Roofing.
I agree.
In this context.
Nobody has had the, chutzpah, to quote my people, to bring it up since Atlas Roofing.
My guest is Harold Krent, a professor at the Chicago Kent College of Law. Hal, this involves George Jarkissi, a former hedge fund manager and conservative radio host. And the SEC found that he had committed securities fraud in 2013 for misleading investors. Hal, tell us about the case and what's at stake here.
This started 10 years ago, and the variety of challenges against the SEC proceedings, and finally, after first losing in the D.C. Circuit, he tried and found more success in the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit decided on three distinct constitutional violations. First, that there was a non-delegation violation in the fact that Congress had not given sufficient guidance to the Securities Exchange Commission about whether to bring a securities fraud action before an ALJ as opposed to in front of a court. And second, that the SEC proceedings were unconstitutionally constructed because the administrative law judges in the Securities Exchange Commission are protected from at-will removal and thus violate Article 2. And the third problem was that the fraud charges that the SEC successfully brought against Charge C echoed those of fraud cases at common law, and that therefore that Charge C should have been granted a jury trial. If the Supreme Court decides all three issues against the SEC, they would have enormous ramifications on the administrative state. That's not likely after listening to the oral argument, but nonetheless, the consequences are dramatic. And briefly, they are that almost every particular individual or firm before an agency, many at least would have the right to a jury trial and not have to go before an administrative tribunal, as is currently the case. That would be one fundamental change. Second would be that all administrative law judges would have to be subject to at-will removal, which would undermine the independence, ironically, of these administrative determinations. And third, there would be some kind of reinvigoration of the non-delegation doctrine, which would limit Congress's ability to delegate issues for administrative agencies to resolve. So very consequential case, very unusual what happened at oral argument, but the stakes couldn't be higher.
So now, before we go into the oral arguments, explain the difference between an administrative law judge and a federal district court judge, known as an Article III judge, and the difference in the proceedings in the different forums.
So the two different tracks of litigation when the government is involved. The first would be before an Article III judge in a federal trial court, and those proceedings are very similar to anything one would see on TV in terms of having rules of evidence. You'd have a judge who is protected from any kind of diminution in salary or removal. You'd have attorneys for both sides arguing subject to delineated rules. And at times, you'd have a jury trial as well if there were money damages at stake. In contrast, in a typical administrative proceeding, of which there are hundreds of thousands a year, you would have an administrative law judge who is appointed by the agency and is subject to removal by the agency, but at least currently only for some kind of misconduct. The proceeding would go before this administrative law judge. The rules of evidence would be much more flexible. In other words, more information could be submitted. In addition, there would be no jury. And so the case would first go before the administrative law judge, but then can be appealed to the administrative agency itself, in this case, the Securities and Exchange Commission. And of course, those are political actors. But then only after the Securities and Exchange Commission would make a decision, then judicial review would be opened up and a court would determine whether the agency reasonably acted in terms of deciding upon a fine or a disgorgement, as indeed both happened in this case. So they're very different tracks. There's judicial involvement in both of them, but one, the judiciary has a review function over the agency and gives the agency some deference in how it conducts the proceedings. And the other, it's much more protective of individual rights, and the individual would have the ability to have a jury check upon any kind of zeal or overreaching by the government in bringing these charges.
Now, Jarkissi contends that defendants in SEC cases have a constitutional right to make their case to a federal jury. And the oral arguments focused almost entirely on that one issue, on the Seventh Amendment, which provides that in suits at common law, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. So tell us about the argument over the Seventh Amendment.
Well, before the argument on the Seventh Amendment, what I think is extraordinary about this case is the two other very significant constitutional arguments that we discussed were hardly mentioned at all during oral argument. And oral argument lasted almost 2 hours. And so the question is why? And I don't know the answer. You only speculate that either the justices were convinced that the other two arguments were not very weighty, and therefore they knew what the result would be, or they might have decided that they were going to throw this case out on the Seventh Amendment grounds anyway, and so they didn't have to decide either the non-delegation argument or the ALJ removability issue. But it is extremely unusual for the court to ignore two very important constitutional challenges in a case of this nature. So that, to me, is the biggest mystery of this case. But turning to the difficult question about the Seventh Amendment, the question is how broad the Seventh Amendment should be construed to extend. On the one hand, an individual has a right to a jury trial, but the courts for 150 years if not more, have said that the jury trial right does not exist if there is a public right involved. And so much of the argument discussed from different perspectives, what is a public right? And the Supreme Court held 50 years ago in a case called Atlas Roofing that a public right would include not only issues between individuals and the government directly, such as taxes and claims like Social Security benefits, but also would include anything under a comprehensive congressional scheme that was devised in order to protect the public. So in that case, Congress had created a mechanism to allow a federal agency, OSHA, to inspect workplaces and fine individual companies for failure to maintain a healthy workplace. And the court said, yes, these kinds of fines are a little bit like negligence claims or wrongful death claims that could be launched against employers. But when the government brings such an action, it does so for a different purpose. It brings the action to protect the public and to try to prevent these kind of workplace accidents. And therefore, in light of this unique public nature, there is no right to a jury trial, and that therefore the government can recover fines even outside of a jury context. And so this is the precedent that the government relied upon, and it has been cited in lots of cases since involving fines in immigration proceedings, in customs proceedings, and so forth. So the stakes are very high in this case. And indeed, much of the argument was talking about line drawing. What is to distinguish the fraud claim under the Securities Act in the Jarczy case from a case involving taxes, involving customs duties, and so forth.
Coming up next, we'll talk about what the decision might look like. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Attention, campers. The new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
I've been talking to Professor Harold Krent of the Chicago Kent College of Law about Supreme Court oral arguments this week over a challenge to the power of the SEC to bring legal actions in-house. The conservative justices seem to be very concerned about the right to a jury in this case. And it struck me as a bit odd because jury trial isn't something they've historically cared about very much, right? They've always pushed forced arbitration.
They have. I mean, certainly it's true. And what is clear out of this discussion is that they have circled back to the importance in 1791 of the ratification of the Seventh Amendment to think that this is a hallmark right that should be preserved by any individual, not only if they're litigating against another company or another individual, but also when they're litigating against the government itself. And that's not how we've recognized that right in the last 75 years. So the court is, I think, using this now as a lever to try to either cut down or diminish the power of these administrative agencies that operate in so many sectors of our lives, from transportation to immigration to workplace safety to environmental safety and so much more. And so by focusing on the Seventh Amendment in a way that they haven't before, they will effectively force agencies to go to court to collect penalties, and that will slow down the administrative process.
Justices Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson said that the Atlas ruling settled the issue here. So would the court have to overrule that 1977 precedent in order to rule for jarczy here?
Likely they would do so, at least in substance, if not in form. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts himself said, well, you know, that Atlas was 50 years ago, and we've seen a lot of that's happened in the last 50 years, including the increasing power of administrative agencies. So it's time for us to take a good look back at it to see if it makes sense today. And to be fair, some of the more conservative justices, particularly Justice Barrett, was struggling to figure out a limiting principle about how you could make the determination of when the Seventh Amendment right would be triggered. For instance, is it just because there's a civil penalty? That would be at least one easily administratable remedy to say, as opposed to, say, a disgorgement penalty or something else, or a cease and desist order. So is that line important? So there was at least some kind of wrangling among some of the conservative justices, not Justice Alito, not Justice Thomas, but the others, about this kind of line drawing. If they extend the Seventh Amendment, how far will the extension be? And at least they were concerned that a literal interpretation of what jarczy was arguing might extend very far indeed.
The Assistant Solicitor General said the government was protecting the rights of the public generally, and when the public's rights are at issue, the right to a jury trial guaranteed by the Seventh Amendment in suits at common law did not apply. Do you agree or disagree that the Seventh Amendment applies to this situation?
I think that the precedent is extremely strong that the Seventh Amendment does not apply. When Congress allows individuals to sue each other before a federal forum, that's where the interest and concern of the Seventh Amendment should be at its strongest. And those are the examples I think the court should be focusing on. But I don't think the court is correct to be concerned about is when the actual challenge is not between two private entities, but between a private entity and the federal government itself. That's really the essence of what a public right is. That's what Justice Scalia said years ago, and that should be the focus here. And so in this case, when we have the government saying that we're not suing on behalf of a private party, we're suing because you have rattled confidence in the securities markets, that's absolutely permissible, and the jury trial right in the Seventh Amendment should not be triggered.
How do you think they're going to rule? Is it going to be a 6-3 ruling, whatever it is?
You know, again, it's so difficult to judge from an oral argument how the court's finally going to come out. But I would guess that they will try to articulate a fuzzy line, but a line that is more restrictive of Congress's ability, really, to determine what kind of suits can be presented before administrative agencies. I doubt they will go as far as to say that Congress can't allow such suits to go before, but they'll probably talk about Congress is limited when the suit is either in all respects similar or echoes or derivative of a common law right. So what the court will want to do is say, use the touchstone of a common law right and say, if you have the right to have a jury trial in a similar case in 1791 in the courts of Westminster, then Congress cannot effectively deprive you of that right by calling it something else, by changing it slightly, and vesting it before an administrative agency. That would be my educated guess.
Let's talk about the ramifications of a decision against the SEC here. For example, will the decision affect the Federal Trade Commission, which uses in-house judges as well?
The decision is likely to affect the Federal Trade Commission. It may affect OSHA. It may affect the customs duties. It depends on the exact test for how to determine whether this particular right of action brought by the government is similar to the suit at common law in 1791. I mean, that is a very archaic way of understanding what Congress can do and can't do in terms of deciding where these particular claims can be brought. But I think that's where the court is headed. And that was the concern that was recognized by counsel for Jarczy, that depending upon the line drawing, the case may either have a modest impact or a tremendous impact. And so even if the court, as it seems, will lean towards Jarczy, the real question is how broad the decision, and that's something they wrestled at. And indeed, Justice Sotomayor said, look, this is a big issue. Neither side has litigated how broad the impact will be of a decision if we strike down the claim in this case. Shouldn't we have more briefing on the issue in recognition of how important it was? And I doubt they will do that. But I mean, her point was, you know, we're just, you know, reaching in the dark here. We don't know exactly how broad of an impact a ruling for Jarczy would have.
This is part of a Supreme Court term that could have broad implications for federal regulators. The justices heard arguments in October over whether the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's funding system is constitutional. And in January, it will consider whether to overturn the Chevron Doctrine, which is a precedent that gives agencies leeway when they interpret ambiguous congressional commands. Why this focus? And do you think federal regulators should be afraid of what's going to happen this term?
Well, it's plain that the focus has arisen from a deep distrust of the administrative state. And the court has signaled in a variety of cases that it wants to pare down the size of government. And it thinks Congress has gone too far in empowering administrative agencies with the ability to investigate and to proceed against mostly companies who violate the regulations that these agencies have promulgated in order to enforce a congressional mission. And so these cases, together with the appointments cases and removal cases that the court previously has articulated, is trying to take another look at how broadly administrative agencies have influence over our lives. But that being said, I think that the court is proceeding probably a little more slowly now than it thought it might 2 years ago. My guess is that they will take some steps to curb the power of administrative agencies, but by ignoring the non-delegation argument today, for instance, they have bypassed an opportunity that would really stick a stake in the heart of most administrative agencies directly, because that could have had an incredibly dramatic impact upon administrative agencies had they held that Congress has to be incredibly clear before an agency can exercise any power whatsoever. Indeed, because the question in this case was so minor, it had to do with whether the agency could use the judgment to decide whether to bring a fraud case before an Article III judge or before an agency. And the argument that the Fifth Circuit bought was because Congress didn't give any guidance as to inform the agency's choice as to which route to take, that itself violated the Constitution. A decision to uphold that understanding of the non-delegation doctrine would have done far more to dismantle the administrative state than with the Seventh Amendment issue that the court spent 2 hours on at oral argument. So, yes, they are thinking about curbing the power of the administrative state, but they're doing so not in as aggressive manner as they might have if they had just seized upon the non-delegation doctrine as a lever in which to accomplish that result.
We'll see how these decisions come out. Thanks so much, Hal. That's Professor Harold Krent of the Chicago Kent College of Law. Coming up, the racketeering trial of a famous rapper. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Attention, campers. The new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island, for the fun of it.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Who is Grammy-winning rapper Young Thug? Is he the ruthless leader of a violent street gang that terrorized Atlanta neighborhoods? Or is he an inspiring success who pulled himself out of poverty to stardom? Those are the competing narratives presented by the prosecution and the defense as the rapper's trial got underway this week. Young Thug, whose given name is Jeffrey Williams, is charged in a sprawling indictment that accuses him and more than two dozen others of conspiring to violate Georgia's anti-racketeering law. He's also charged with gang, drug, and gun crimes and is standing trial with five of the others indicted with him. Joining me is former U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Georgia, Michael Moore, a partner at Moore Hall.
Even before the opening statements, there have been almost 10 months of jury selection and courtroom drama. It started with 28 alleged street gang members as defendants. The trial is down to six. Do all these months of problems have any impact on the trial?
Well, I think it could. I mean, we started with an extraordinarily long jury selection and, you know, trying not only to find people who may not have some familiarity with the case, but some familiarity with witnesses and otherwise, but also folks who may just have the time to sit for this long in a trial like this. It can be difficult. And so I think that started the case off with some problems, and then you've seen other issues that have come up with some issues with some of the lawyers and things that have happened in the courtroom and whether or not there have been threats. And, you know, it's been a little bit of a circus, I think, frankly, at this point, and may continue through the duration of the presentation.
Tell us about the RICO indictment, about the case, what the prosecution is charging.
RICO really deals with racketeer-influenced corrupt organizations. And if you think about it, maybe in layman's terms, it's really talking about things like organized crime. And so you saw some RICO cases, that is, going after these organizations, the mob, basically, where they would try to take down the mob leader by essentially attributing the bad conduct of his underlings to him. In other words, they didn't have to find the mafia don pulling the trigger. They could actually have a murder committed by somebody else, but they could talk about this was a goal and an effort of this criminal enterprise to either obtain money or property, and that's how they went after the organization. Recently, you've seen RICO cases used not only in drug cases and drug conspiracy type cases, but also there was one relatively well-known case in Atlanta where a RICO case was used involving public schools and the cheating scandal that went on. Some of those people, I think, had their cases, maybe got some of them reversed, but some certainly were convicted. And probably the most famous one right now that we're hearing about is the Trump campaign. But it's a prosecutor's dream, really, because it allows them to basically paint everybody with the negative brush. And so they can bring in a lot of evidence. They get to attribute all the bad conduct of your co-defendant to you, if you're a defendant. And it's more of a, I guess, a case involving either directions to do wrong or involvement to do wrong, or sometimes just knowledge of people who are doing wrong. All that evidence gets to come in. And at the end of the day, the prosecution asks the jury to convict you because you were part of this organization. So it's not an uncontroversial statute. Many people think that it allows prosecutors too much leeway in bringing cases, but they tend most of the time to be complex and involved and sometimes unruly, as you're seeing in this case.
This sort of sounds like a movie script because Georgia is accusing this Grammy-winning rapper of leading a street gang that's fronted by his record label. And the crimes include killings and shootings and carjackings.
Right. And it's easy, remember, to charge people with a crime. It's sometimes harder to prove that. And so the state, in this, as they do in every criminal case, but certainly here, they'll have to come forward and put on some evidence that the main defendant was really in control of what was going on by other people on the street. I think that gets harder to do if we are just have realistic conversations about what actually happens in the real world in certain neighborhoods and areas of town, and, you know, that type of thing. And the prosecutors will have to explain how that's not just what I'll call street level crime, but was actually part of this larger umbrella that they've charged as part of this RICO case.
They do have some people who pled, right, who are going to testify.
They do. They do. I mean, and that's another reason that prosecutors like the RICO case, is it allows them to sort of pick off defendants through plea agreements, and then they begin to develop evidence in the case. It's always interesting to me to see how RICO cases can be charged by a grand jury, but then the prosecutor still needs the evidence from co-defendants who later plea to try to pull the puzzle pieces together to really give a better picture of what these cases or the organization is charged as part of these cases, what it looks like.
What really interests me in this case is that the judge has ruled that prosecutors can use his lyrics as evidence of his involvement in the crime. So they can present 17 sets of lyrics as evidence, provided they can link their content to real-world crimes. That's been done before. Is it controversial, though?
It is controversial, and I don't know, frankly, how I feel about it. I think it's probably pushing the envelope a little bit. And while it's not the first time, so it's not really precedent setting, there are other cases where this has happened, I do think it raises some pretty unique questions about the First Amendment, about, you know, artists' creativity, and then whether or not later that can be used in a case. You can think about cases, you know, woe be it for any country music star to either be charged with drunk driving or get a divorce, because that's going to come up. Does that mean now that that's going to be evidence in their case? That they talked about, you know, drinking too many drinks or chasing too many paramours or whatever the case may be, or, you know, smoking too much weed or, you know, whatever. Is that now going to be the norm? And I think those are the kind of lines where this type of admission of evidence, of this specific type of evidence, it gets blurry, frankly. And, I was thinking, as I thought some about the case, if you're defending a case like this, or you're just representing an artist, a music artist, are you well advised to suggest to them to just write a couple of songs with really acceptable lyrics? Things like, I love the police, I never commit a crime, I don't do drugs, and say, well, here's evidence now by good care. You know, if anything ever happened, I want you to put this in. You know, that's something that ought to go in, too. I assure you that the people who are prosecuting the case would say no, but somehow here this evidence is coming in. Limiting instructions, too, to a jury, and that may be what the judge has in mind when he talks about you have to link it up and all this. And if he may limit the jury or tell them, well, you can only consider this if it looks like it went to an actual crime, those are often a little prophylactic, and that's about it, because juries pay great attention to what prosecutors put into evidence. And a prosecution, like it or not, the reality is that a prosecution team goes in, I think, oftentimes with an advantage in a case, and that is that jurors want to believe them. Sort of like you want to trust your doctor. You know, you want to trust the prosecutor. You want to trust your preacher. It's just something that's sort of ingrained in us, I think, to have this trust. Not everybody, but by and large, I think they look for somebody to explain to them what the case is about, what the evidence is going to show, what it has shown at the end of the case, and they often expect the prosecutor to do that. And so the fact that the evidence comes in under the guise of a prosecution presentation, I don't think it's cured by some of the limiting efforts that may have to happen in this case, because we don't know until they get further along that they're going to be able to connect the dots to these specific lyrics, you know, and I think that can pose a problem later.
Some of the references that I've seen are, you know, a little ambiguous, and the defense said that not only it's a violation of free speech, but that it would be unfairly prejudicial. So do you think that will be an appellate issue?
I think there's no question. I mean, there have been cases where it's been allowed, but I think this will be ripe for an appeal, especially when they think about how broad things have gotten. And I think that's one of the concern, and we're seeing it in other cases. I mean, right, we're seeing it in political cases, too, right now, and in those types of things where some of what I would call the protective norms that we've kind of held sacrosanct, we're willing to bend those a little bit because we think that the end is going to justify the means to get there. So, for instance, here, are we getting our hands a little too tightly around the neck of the First Amendment and the free speech of people, all for the sake of getting some small piece of evidence in the hopes that that might be what pushes the jury over the edge to a conviction, as opposed to looking for that evidence through witness testimony, co-defendant testimony, physical evidence, videotapes, whatever it is. We're saying we're going to sacrifice a little bit of what we've known traditionally as protections of the First Amendment in order to get to this other place. And I do think that's going to raise interesting issues. And even though the evidence has been used in other cases, appellate courts are known as time passes and things change and technology evolves and all of that. They're known for shifting or revisiting some of those issues later on. And so I think this will be ripe if he is convicted or if anyone is convicted in this trial and the evidence has been used for that. I think this is the kind of thing that will be ripe for an appeal.
Sweet. In the opening statements, the long opening statements of the defense attorney told, you know, his rags to riches story, incidents where the rapper's 20-year-old brother was shot near their building. And he sort of changed the narrative. He said THUG stands for Truly Humbled Under God, and YSL, the alleged gang, doesn't stand for Young Slime Life. It stands for the luxury clothing brand Yves Saint Laurent. I mean, he's trying to change the entire narrative of who this rapper is. Is the jury going to pick between this version of him and the totally opposite version that the prosecution's presenting?
Well, you know, and sometimes lawyers have to sort of dance with what brung them, if you will, and or play the cards they've been dealt. And so in this case, the lawyer may have been looking for some way to make a distinction. I do think, though, that the rag to riches story is the type of thing that plays into what we talked about a minute ago, and that is the lyrics. And is this artist writing about what he saw as his life experience, or an experience of his friends, or something that he believed might be relatable in his music genre to his audience? And is this something there, as opposed to some type of cryptic message about crimes that had taken place or that he had been a part of? And so those will be things they have to ferret out. I'm mindful, though, as we think about how a lawyer might, you know, change the narrative. I mean, remember that we've seen in famous cases a narrative change. We've gone from a bloody crime scene photo to scenes of somebody trying to pull on a leather glove and an argument about if it doesn't fit, you must acquit, you know. Mm-hmm. And so the lawyer may try to change that narrative here in this case to get the jury's attention on, you know, this is who he was, this is how he's come up, this is why he writes these lyrics, this is why he has this circle of friends. This is, this is him as a person, but he's now at a place where he's so successful that this idea of sort of street crime at the level that's alleged in the indictment is outside of what he does. And that's why he may be talking about things like, you know, designer clothes as opposed to the gang name and such as that.
Thanks so much, Michael. That's Michael Moore of Moore Hall.
And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news by listening to our Bloomberg Law podcasts. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcasts/law. And attorneys, looking for legal research? Whether you're an in-house counsel or in private practice, Bloomberg Law gives you the edge with the latest in AI-powered legal analytics, business insights, and workflow tools. With guidance from our experts, you'll grasp the latest trends in the legal industry, helping you achieve better results. For the practice of law, the business of law, the future of law, visit BloombergLaw.com. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Attention campers, the new Camp Snoopy at Kings Island brings your family summer camp fun all season long. Head to Camp Snoopy with Charlie Brown and the whole Peanuts gang for fun and adventure. Race forwards and backwards on the new family boomerang coaster, Snoopy Soapbox Racers. Explore on your own with more space to roam at Beagle Scout Acres. And don't forget to grab a snack at Pigpen's Mess Hall. It's a new way to play with the Peanuts gang at Camp Snoopy. Now open, only at Kings Island. for the fun of it.